Good morning, Boker Tov. I want to thank our sponsors, Benji and Zeldi Henner, for sponsoring this morning's Parsha class in honor of our amazing BRS security team. If you'd like to join the security team, it's not too late. We are always in need of more volunteers, and so grateful to the Henners for their sponsorship. Parsha Shoftim is on page 1024 in the Art Scroll Stone Chumash. We continue with Sefer Dvarim. Last week we began Yitav Lev, the beautiful insight. If you take the names of all the Parshios in succession, you see the theme of this time of year, that this period of the year begins from these are the words all the way through. So now we're Shoftim, that we are Re'eh. Notice Shoftim that we're going to soon be standing in front of Hashem. Our Parsha begins, Shoftim v'shotrim titein lecha b'chol sha'arecha asher Hashem lokecha nasein lecha l'shvatecha. The Bali Musar encourages to read this not only the mandate, which of course is literal, that we are obligated to have judges and policemen. We have those who legislate the law and those who enact and preserve the observance of the law. It's not only true in the sense communal or national, that within our communities and our land we have to have it. The Bali Musar understand this to be a mandate referring to our private lives. Kol sha'arecha, in all of our gates, means our eyes, our ears, our mouth, all the gateways to the body, which really are gateways to the soul, because the body houses the soul, and the soul makes choices through the vehicle, through the instrument of the body. So all the sha'arim, all the gateways of the body, the eyes, in which we see the world, velosasur acharei nechem, the ears, in which we listen, we hear, we could possibly accept that which we shouldn't be listening to, the mouth, and so on and so forth. Shoftim v'shotrim, it means that we need to place these guards at all of the entry points through which we make choices. Torah tells us, be very careful, when you appoint these judges, do not accept bribery, because we're all vulnerable to bribery. You could be incredibly brilliant, but you're vulnerable, you're susceptible to being bribed. Whether you're a chacham or a tzaddik, you're wise or you're righteous, if a person is not vigilant to preserve their moral compass, to preserve their sense of integrity, it's so easy to slip, and it is so easy to become corrupt. That is the power. We know that power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's one of the themes of our parsha. We'll see it when it comes to the melech, the king as well. All of the things that are put in place in order to protect the king. So here we have the judges, it was true for the prophet, and it's true for the king. Then all of these different positions of power, one has to be vigilant never to become corrupt. Torah says, Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. L'matechya v'yarashter sa'aretz asher Hashem alokecha nosein lach. Righteousness, righteousness shall you pursue. L'man tichye. It's kind of a funny continuation of the pasuk. L'ma'an tichye. Why does it say l'ma'an tichye? There's a number of peculiar things about the pasuk. L'ma'an tichye. But even the word rodef, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, righteousness, righteousness, shall you pursue. My niece is visiting from Israel. Her other grandfather is a federal judge in New York, and I believe in his chamber or on his bench he has this pasuk, or when he was sworn in, he quoted it. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, righteousness, righteousness, shall you pursue. Tirdof is the same root of the word rodef. Now, rodef, we don't usually use in a positive context. It doesn't have a positive connotation. What's a rodef? Rodef is a pursuer. Yeah. Someone who's pursuing someone else to murder them, to kill them. One is allowed to intervene. One is allowed to kill the rodef in order to protect, in order to preserve the life of the nirdaf, of the one who's being pursued. And yet, that word rodef, which has a negative connotation, is dafke, specifically the word the Torah is using here. And then Netziv, in his commentary, HaMikdavar, says it's not a coincidence. Because righteousness will never be achieved or attained if you're waiting back for it, if you're passive, if you're sitting back, if you're waiting to take care of it, maybe in a passive sense. But rather, tirdof, one has to prescriptively, one has to actively, one has to, with initiative, pursue. The same way we use that word rodef to describe the pursuer who's trying to kill someone, in the inverse, that level of pursuit, the level of passion or enthusiasm or energy has to be there in the pursuit of righteousness and justice. Aaron was right. To be a student of Aaron was loved Torah, loved people, loved the brios. and was Rodev Shalom, pursued Shalom. So even though it normally has negative connotations, it elicits the image of a murderer, here the Torah is using the same word. So the Netziv writes, L'mantichya v'yarashta esa'aretz asher Hashem Elokecha nosein lach, that righteousness you should pursue so you will live. Meaning, your life is only meaningful, your life is only justified if you live a life not only where, when an opportunity presents itself to you, you respond with righteousness, but tzedek tzedek, tirdof. You have to not only respond with righteousness when we confront a choice, but we have to pursue righteousness, preserve righteousness, to the extent that when we see a lack of righteousness and injustice happening to us or happening to others, that we try to intervene, we try to intercede. Only when we are proactive, not just reactive, when it comes to tzedek, to righteousness. So then the Tziv says, HaRodev Achar Tzedek Masig Simchas HaNefesh Bagia Liyado Inyan Meshubach V'Matziya Le'or HaTzedek V'Hu Chayus HaNefesh. Sorry, I don't know what's going on. The camp outside or the fire alarm? Not sure. So the Netziv says, "Why? What's the continuation of the pasuk? Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Pursue, run after righteousness. Leman tichyeh, so that you live. What's the connection? So that you live and the righteousness. And so the Netziv explains, Simchas HaNefesh. When do you achieve a Simchas HaNefesh? When is your soul most gratified? Leman tichyeh, when is it most alive? When it's not only reacting to preserve justice, but it's proactive. When a person feels they're here for a mission, that they're making a difference in the world. How many of the movements throughout history to preserve social justice, social righteousness, have been led by and have been pursued by Jews? This is where it comes from. Social justice is a core Jewish value. Torah, guided by Torah, not guided by our own human relative instinct, but guided by Torah values. But the pursuit of social justice, it's tragic that in our community we seem to have relegated that to other denominations, or other denominations maybe seem to have hijacked that component of Judaism, or lagoyim of tzedek tzedek, of social justice, but that's part of what it means to be an observant Torah Jew, a religious Jew, and that's what the Netziv is saying. Leman tichyeh. If you want to be alive as a religious Jew, it's not just about the righteousness in the shul. It's not how hard you shuckle, it's not how much daf you cover in learning, all critically important to the core definition of a Jew, but it's also how we conduct ourselves outside the shul, at work, in life, and not only reacting, but being proactive for the pursuit of justice. Therefore, HaRodev Achar Tzedek Masig Simchas HaNefesh Bagia Liyado Inyam Meshubach V'Hu Motziya Le'or HaTzedek V'Hu Chayes HaNefesh. Says in Netziv, it's the most gratifying, it makes you feel the most alive to be participating among those who are pursuing justice. Why the redundancy? Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Why not tzedek, tirdof? Righteousness. Pursue righteousness once. Why is it repeated twice? This is an amazing Medrash Tanchuma. I've shared it before. I think one year, one of the Parsha classes, we spent the whole time on this pasuk, which we're not going to do right now. But this Medrash Tanchuma says, Lama kasav tzedek, tzedek, shtei pa'amim. Why the redundancy? Why twice? Ela mikan azhar la dayanim, shelo yiyu chosh... Don't rush to judgment. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof. Don't rush, sleep on it. Give a judgment in the morning. Sometimes you hear in your first impression, the first instinct, the first response, turns out wasn't right. The more you, when you slept on it, when you marinated in it a little bit, you came back the next day and you had more clarity. And therefore you were able to better preserve what's most right, what's most just. So the Medrash says, tzedek, tzedek tirdof. Listen to the case, hear all the testimony, and sleep on it. And don't give a judgment till the next day, because with time, you'll be able to come to a better conclusion, you'll be able to have due process. Maybe they're drilling for oil out there. Wouldn't that be great? Solve the shul's problems. They're up on the roof? Okay. Right, we better have to better coordinate. Lastly, tzedek tzedek. So there's another medrash that has another interpretation of tzedek tzedek. And this is the one I find so meaningful. The medrash says, tzedek, bitzedek tirdof. Righteousness, pursue it with righteousness. How many people with the most noble intention and for the most righteous cause use a lack of righteousness in its pursuit. How many people, in the pursuit of a righteous and just and noble cause, act with a lack of righteousness? The way they treat others, in distorting the facts, in not being fair and balanced. In the pursuit of so-called righteousness, they are stepping all over and distorting righteousness. So the Torah says, tzedek, bitzedek tirdof. Pursue righteousness, but don't ever think that the ends justifies the means. Don't think that in the pursuit of righteousness, you can compromise righteousness, because after all, your cause is so righteous. Now, I'll just share with you in closing on this section, Rabbi Soloveitchik's interpretation. We saw his predecessor, the Netziv, Leman Tichyeh. Why is it tzedek, tzedek, pursue righteousness and you live? So the Rav quotes the Ramban, and the Ramban quotes the Sefer HaBahir, which is a great Kabbalistic work, which interprets the pasuk as follows. If you judge yourself, you shall live. And if not, he will judge you against your will. What's the connection of Leman Tichyeh? Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, Leman Tichyeh. Whose tzedek are you defending? Who are you evaluating? Who is on trial? Not tzedek, tzedek vis-a-vis others. I'm not sitting in judgment of other people. It's a homiletical interpretation. Obviously, the pasuk is talking about the judge on the bench. But now, the Ramban is quoting this Kabbalistic work, and the Rav is explaining it's an instruction to every one of us that as we live our lives, don't sit in judgment of others. Don't draw conclusions about others. Don't fail to give others the benefit of the doubt. The only one that we need to be judging is ourselves. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Pursue judgment of yourself and try to live with righteousness. Leman tichyeh, so that you live. We're required to judge ourselves, engage in introspection. Each of us must split himself in two persona, judge and defendant. Shoftim v'shotrim titein l'cha b'chol sha'arecha, set up judges at our gates. Listen to the Rav, so beautiful. Closing off all escape routes, all spurious rationales which stop us from genuine introspection. This parasha is generally the first one read in the month of Elul. Before the Yom Narayim, one must approach himself as an objective observer and provide an honest assessment. So that's why we read this parasha. We're now in Elul. Shoftim v'shotrim titein l'cha b'chol sha'arecha, so that when tzedek tzedek tirdof, when you're looking in the mirror, when you're reflecting, when you're doing the hard work of introspection to evaluate and judge ourselves, and we're in two. On the one hand, we're the judge. On the other hand, we're the defendant. So place shoftim v'shotrim at your gates. Make sure you can't run away from the truth. You can't hide from the reality, as inconvenient sometimes as it is, as uncomfortable sometimes as it makes us. The Torah then continues in the same context of the pursuit of justice, and seems a pasuk having nothing to do with it. You cannot place a tree, an idolatrous tree, any tree near the altar of Hashem that you shall make for yourself. An Asherah is a specific tree that used to be a form of idolatry, of pagan worship. They would worship the tree. It was called the Asherah tree. There's a whole halachic discussion. Can you plant a tree in the courtyard of a shul? Or just like near the altar, there shouldn't be a tree on Har HaBayis, the Beis HaMikdash. So too, there shouldn't be trees near our shuls. The Rav references a whole discussion about it. But Chazal have a very interesting interpretation here. When it comes to this pasuk about L'sita L'cha Asherah, Chazal say that a person, Chazal says in the name of Resh Lakish, it's a Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Zayin, whoever appoints an incompetent judge, it's as though he planted an Asherah in the Jewish people, and it quotes our pasuk. First we talked about having judges, and then we say don't have the Asherah tree. What's the connection? Why the continuation? Because if you have a corrupt judge, it's as if you planted an Asherah. What's the connection between the two? A corrupt judge, a judge who doesn't execute justice, and a pagan tree, what's the connection between the two? Any suggestions? So Reb Chaim, the Rav's grandfather, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, said that an incompetent judge is compared to an Asherah because idolatrous shrines are generally identifiable. The Asherah appears like an ordinary tree. Outwardly, it's beautiful, but its essence is rotten. So to a judge who outwardly appears qualified, but inwardly is incompetent. One who judges righteously is given extraordinary authority to act in lieu of the divine judge. In reality, no human being is capable or has the right to judge or decide the fate of another. He never knows the absolute truth. A dayan, a judge, is called in Hebrew Elohim. The same name that we have for God is the word in Torah that we use for a judge. Why? Because he is of necessity granted a divine prerogative. Consequently, if a human judge is incompetent, he in effect usurps divine authority and desecrates it. It's akin to idolatry. So a judge needs to know their mortality. A judge needs to know their humility. A judge needs to realize that only God knows the truth, the accurate truth. The judge relies on divine assistance. We have psukim that describe that God stands with the judge, because the judge is relying on hashkacha pratis. The judge sits ba'atifas arosh, his head is covered, like when davening, because the judge relies on divine assistance in order to be able to arrive at the truth. If a judge is corrupt, if a judge is willing to bend the truth, then they have usurped divine authority, and that's akin to idolatry. Figuratively, he has planted an idolatrous shrine in the very place which was imbued with divine justice, near the altar. According to the Rambam, this opinion of Reish Lakish constitutes a biblical prohibition. It's not just an asmachta, that a judge who judges corruptly is as if he has worshipped an idol or provides or plants an idolatrous tree in the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, the parsha continues. Again, we're just giving an overview, and then we're going to go through specific pesukim towards the end. Somebody who worships idols, what we do, the purpose who practices idols, who worships idolatry rather. The law that it takes two, the testimony of two, in order to arrive at the truth. Three different areas of halacha. What do you do? So what do you do? A shaila arises. A question arises. What do? You go to the judge, Asher Yeh Bayamim Haheim. All you have is the judge in your generation. The Gemara realizes this and says, Yiftach Bedoro Kishmuel Bedoro. Yiftach was looked at not as one of the great judges, one of the great shoftim. Yiftach, his own background, Yiftach's own life, is a story unto itself. But Yiftach was no Shmuel. Shmuel Hanavi was among the greatest. And yet our rabbis encourage us, Yiftach Bedoro Kishmuel Bedoro. We may wish we had greater leadership. Elsewhere, Chazal tell us, the leadership is a reflection of the people we lead. They lead. If we bemoan the quality of our leadership, it's a reflection of ourselves. Hashem provides leaders who are appropriate for the people they are leading. So if we bemoan the quality of our leaders, we should look in the mirror. But Yiftach Bedoro Kishmuel Bedoro, as Shafet Asher Yeh Bayamim Mahem, whomever is the leader of that generation, that's who we turn to. That's who we rely upon, as if they were Shmuel Bedoro, as if it was Shmuel, as if it was Moshe. That's the leadership in our generation, and we have to listen to them. Apia Torah she'erucha v'meshbar asher milucha ta'aseh, v'sasim en adavar asher yegidu lucha yamin u'smol. This is the Torah obligation to listen to everything the rabbis tell us. So the rabbis have the capacity to introduce Chanukah and Purim. The Rambam understands from here, when you make a bracha, when you light the Chanukah candles, Asher Kiddushonu Mitzvasav Tzivanu L'Hadlik Ner Shel Chanukah, how could you possibly say that? It's a lie. Asher Kiddushonu B'Mitzvasav V'Tzivanu? God, you commanded me to light Chanukah candles? Where? You're holding a Chumash. Where did Hashem command us to light Chanukah candles? He didn't. So how can you say V'Tzivanu? The answer is, L'Sosim and Adav Asher Yagidu L'Cha Yamin Yismol. He empowered Chazal as his mouthpiece and said, whatever Chazal tell you, they represent my ratzon, my will. You must observe their law. It's a biblical responsibility or obligation to observe rabbinic law. The discussion I mentioned the last night between the Ramban and the Rambam on that notion. If that's the case, why isn't every rabbinical law a biblical law? Every din derabbanan is a din deraisa, which means what? We have rules. Safek deraisa. If you have a doubt whether you fulfilled the biblical commandment, what should you do? L'chumra, you're strict. Safek derabbanan, l'kula, you're lenient. So if every derabbanan is a deraisa, really is a Torah obligation. If every Darabanan is a Daraisa, why do we go Lakula on the Darabanan? We should go Lachumra as if it's a Daraisa. It's a good question, right? So it's a big discussion. There are answers. One answer given is, who says the rule is in itself a biblical rule? Maybe that rule is a rabbinic rule. Savik Daraisa Lachumra, Savik Darabanan Lakula. Is that rule itself Daraisa Darabanan? It's a big discussion in Sefer HaMitzvos, the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvos, and the Ramban's commentary on it. But this is the obligation. Now, principally speaking, it's the obligation to observe the rules of the Sanhedrin. That when Chazal, when the Beis Din HaGadol, when the Sanhedrin, Anshei Knesset HaGadola, when the formal official rabbinic courts enacted rabbinic law, whether it's the rabbinic law that are gzeros, that prevent us from going over the edge of biblical law, or takanos, they enact new laws like Hanukkah or Purim, this is our responsibility and obligation to listen to the rabbis. In fact, so much so, this is what we spoke about last night, Rashi here says, even if they tell you right is left and left is right, even if they got it wrong, you have to follow what they say. Even if they got it wrong, you have to follow what they say. Which is a bizarre comment. Yes. If it's a choice between following what God said or how the rabbis are misinterpreting it, why would you follow how the rabbis misinterpret it? Let's assume you know. You know they made a mistake. Rashi says, look at Rashi right here. So much so, the Sifri's original language, Rashi's quoting, says, Nirin Lecha. It appears to you they're wrong. The Barbanel and others say it must be that. Because it has to only be it appears to you they're wrong. If they're wrong, why in the world would you follow them? But the Ran understands Rashi to be saying literally, no, they're wrong. And yet you follow them over the will of Hashem. Why would you ever follow them if they're wrong? They're human, good, so they're fallible, it's forgivable. Doesn't mean you should follow them. So why would you follow them? Correct. Once you rule that you should follow them when they're wrong, now, how do you know they're right? How do you know they're wrong? Haven't you undermined the entire system? But again, let's say objectively we know, empirically we know, that even though they've said one thing, we know they're wrong. Good, Barashi says, Afili yagidecha yamin shu smol v'smol shu yamin. They're wrong. Follow them anyway. But why not? God says, don't eat treif, meat and milk mixed together. Beis Din tells you about a certain particular mixture, you could eat it. You say, what do you mean? That's right, that's left, that's wrong, that's right. What are you talking about? So the Ran, the Drashas Aran, says an answer. Rosh Hashanah says, you're making a mistake if you think that for the Ribono Shalom, it's only about the technical rule. The technical rule is important. But you know what's even more important? That you're following His will. And His will is that you listen to the Rabbanan. That means to say, Torah and Mitzvot is a process of being engaged in a relationship with Hashem. So when Hashem says, eat this, don't eat this, don't observe that, live this way, say this, don't say that, in truth, He's giving us a prescription for a most meaningful life for ourselves. But He's also saying, I want to see how invested you are in a relationship with Me. So now, what's the greatest test? I shared this insight, the Drosha Saran. I had the privilege of speaking in shul the Shabbos morning of my brother's Ufruf in Tinek. And this was the Drosha that I gave. I guess their Hebrew anniversary is this coming week. Is that true? It must be. So I quoted this Drosha Saran. I said, you know, in marriage, sometimes your spouse is going to ask you to do something. They're going to ask you to do something that makes no sense to you. That seems completely wrong and backwards to you. So now, what do you do then? What do you do then? Do you say, let me explain to you why you're wrong? Do you spend time making the argument, providing the evidence, trying to persuade the spouse for why they're wrong, why what they want makes no sense whatsoever? Or do you say, even if I win that battle, I've lost. So you know what? If you want that, I'm happy to do it. So Kadosh Baruch Hu says, I've set up a system where the Chazal are my mouthpiece, and I want you to listen to them. And I they're saying something that doesn't make sense to you, okay, are you in a relationship with me? Then do what I've asked, even if it doesn't make sense to you. How do I know you're in a relationship with me? When you're willing to do what I ask, even when it doesn't make sense to you. Afil yagid lecha yamin shu smol, v'smol shu yamin. The amazing Sefer HaChinuch says on this pasuk, the Sefer HaChinuch says that this mandate, lo sasu, you have to listen to Chazal, was not only true in the time that Chazal themselves were legislating new law. Rabbis today don't have the right. All we do is take precedent and apply precedent to new situations and new technology and new medical breakthrough that arises. I guess we get the guys off the roof. Baruch Hashem. Simon Bracha, the rain. So Chazal, the rabbis of today, contemporary Rabbanim, don't have that power, of course. We don't have real smicha. We are teachers and educators. But the Sefer HaChinuch says something amazing. He says, no. The responsibility to follow the Balei HaMesorah of every generation. New issues arrive in every generation. There's the question of pushing the envelope in every generation, whether it's technology, medical breakthrough, issues of gender, issues of orientation, issues of, who knows, the issues we're dealing with today we never would have dreamt of 10 years ago, and the issues that we'll face tomorrow we would never dream of today. So who is empowered to decide where are the boundaries? Who is empowered to determine what's our Mesorah, what's our tradition, what's okay, what's not okay? So the Balei HaMesorah of every generation, there's no test, there's no license. You don't go to get a license to be one of the members of the Balei HaMesorah. How that's defined is for another time. But the Sefer HaChinuch writes, Mishar she ha-mitzvah l'shedeus b'nei adam chalukim zeh mizeh. People have many diverse opinions. Lo yishtavu l'olam har b'deus b'dvarim. V'yeda adon ha-kol baruch hu she'ilu tiyah kavanas k'suvei ha-torah mesura b'yad kol echa v'echa b'nei adam. If we would just empower every individual to be able to ish ish k'fi sichlo yifrish kol echa me'am divrei torah k'fi svar aso. So if we said to everyone, interpret the Torah the way it means for you, the way it's comfortable for you, the way you understand it, what would happen? Yarba ha-machlokas b'Yisrael b'mashmos ha-mitzvos. There would be tremendous conflict. Everyone would be observing in their own way. Everyone would interpret in their own style. V'tasa ha-Torah kekama toros. The Jewish people would be fragmented, we'd be divided. And the Torah, the religion itself, would appear as if we have multiple religions. And therefore the Torah empowers the Chachamim of each generation. And the Sefer HaChinuch says, until today. He says, this mitzvah applies to us today. That when the Gedolei Yisrael of the generation, when the Balei HaMesorah of a generation say, Ad kan v'sulo, here is the boundary. I know that innovation seems attractive. I know that new idea or practice sounds compelling. But no, here are the boundaries. Here's why it's not. We have to rely on the Balei HaMesorah of every generation. When Rav Schechter talks about this, he gives the example. I hear this from Rav Schechter, maybe Rav Asher Weiss told it. No, I heard this one from Rav Asher Weiss. He said to me, you know, the Chassam Sofer in his time, when he opposed the origin of the Reform movement, and the Reform wanted to introduce translating the davening into German. The Siddur was to be published in German. And that was the major innovation of its time. So, is that against halacha? No. The Mishnah in Sota says, Tefillah b'chol lashon. You could daven in every language, any language. If you don't understand the Hebrew, certainly you could daven in any language. Rabbi Brody's Friday Night Live and other such programs. People daven in English. I encourage you, if you don't understand the Hebrew, it'll be more meaningful daven in English. So Tefillah b'chol lashon, you're allowed to daven in every language. And if you could daven in any language, what was the problem of their translating the Siddur into German? So Rav Asher Weiss said to me, you see how prescient, how prophetic the Chassam Sofer was. Because he wasn't just looking at that particular innovation. He saw where it was going and what it would lead to. We see today that innovation, the levels of assimilation and intermarriage and patrilineal descent and the really very sad corruption of our sacred Torah. I'm not making a judgment of the people of other movements. We love them dearly. We love all of our Jewish brothers and sisters dearly and respect them all dearly. But that way of observance is a corruption of our understanding, a corruption of our sacred Torah. So L'Sasman Adavar She'agidu Lacha Yamin Ismol says the Sefer HaChinuch, it was not just true when Halacha was still being developed, it remains in force Ara Yom Hazeh until today. That the Bali HaMesora, the ambassadors of Torah of every generation, again, how is it determined who qualifies, who is part of that elite group? It's for another time, but it's that group to whom we have to defer and that we have to trust in order to carry the torch, in order to carry the torch forward. Okay, the Torah says, continues about the rebellious elder, the obligation of a king. Som tasim alecha melech, ashevchar Hashem elokecha bo, nikar v'achicha, the responsibility to choose a king. Here the Torah seems to have it as a mitzvah to have a king. Here we have a mitzvah to have a king. Whereas in Sefer Shmuel, when the people come and they want a king, what does the Torah? Shmuel criticizes them. Well, how dare you come forward and demand and ask for a king? What was the difference between then and now? The difference was their motivation of why they demanded and wanted that king. Here the Torah wants a king because it becomes a metaphor, an allegory for the way with which we relate to Hashem. We connect to Hashem as a king and his servants, and if we have a human construct, it'll help enhance our relationship with Hashem. It should be because it's Hashem's will. When they came and asked for a king, why did they want a king? Like all the other nations of the world. It wasn't a religious motivation. In fact, it was a religious rebelliousness. They wanted to be like all the other nations of the world. We are encouraged. We read this parsha in the month of Elul that Som Tasim Alecha Melech, we're going to change our language. Aseres Yimei Tshuva from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, we introduce and we emphasize that word Melech over and over. Our mission on Rosh Hashanah is to be Mamlech Hashem. When we arrive at Rosh Hashanah, to stand before Hashem and to be Mamlechim. So we're encouraged to read this Som Tasim Alecha Melech. What kind of king do we place over ourselves? The Melech Malchei Amlachim, that it's referring to, of course, the King of Kings. This king has many rules. One of his rules, don't have too many horses, don't have too many wives, no comparison between the two, but don't indulge in too many of any of these pleasures because you will lose perspective. Who thought he was better and tried to do it? Shlomo HaMelech, the wisest of all men. He thought, well, I know the reason, and since I am not vulnerable to the reason, I am exempt, and therefore he did violate it, and he paid a very, very heavy price as a result. Levilti rum levavo me'achav, levilti surman ha-mitzvah yamin ismol. The king is in grave danger. As we said, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. This king, who has enormous power, this king is vulnerable to arrogance, and therefore the king is mandated to carry around with him at all times a little Sefer Torah. A little Sefer Torah. Why? Because the king has to be engaged in learning. What is the only way to avoid, to combat the natural instinct or inclination towards arrogance, towards ego, towards hubris? Is learning Torah. The king has to read every day. He has to learn every day. He has to be engaged in study, in expanding his mind, in exercising his intellect, and having perspective and scope and context to his role. And this is true for the king, it's true for people in all positions of power. They have to be able to. I read an article in the Wall Street Journal a few years ago that tracked different presidents, how much time they made for reading and what they read and how important reading was within their presidency. I don't know, I guess today it would be 140 characters or less would be read, whatever the amount of reading that would get done, that when a person is in a position of great power, that the melech had a mitzvah, had a mandate, and I think that's very instructive for all of us as well. The responsibility, the obligation of the priestly gifts, that just as when you brought in your produce, you separated a portion and it went to the priest, so too when your animals, you had to give the zroa, l'chayayim, and keva, you had to give these parts of the animal to the Kohen as well. References to prophecy, prophets, and then we get to Ir Miklat. Story of the Ir Miklat, which is a repetition. Story of the Ir Miklat, if a person kills by accident, they go where? To a city of refuge. They had the same amount of cities of refuge east of the Yarden in the area of Reuven, Gad, and half of Manasseh as they had in the rest of Israel. Why did they have the same amount of Ir Miklat? 3 and 3. 2.5 tribes. And the rest of the tribes, that's not exactly a proportional distribution of the cities of refuge. So Chazal understands why. Because those 3 tribes, 2.5 tribes, were more likely to have cases of accidental murder. What predisposed them to have more cases of accidental murder? What did they emphasize more than the other tribes? Why did they ask to settle east of the Yarden? Mikne Rav Hayal of Negad of Ne Ruvain. They said, you know, we have a lot of business opportunity. Money. Business opportunity. They had great ambition in terms of professionally. So much so, remember that Moshe gives them very subtle, nuanced rebuke. They say, please, let us settle east of the Yarden. We have a lot of flock. We'll settle. And we'll go into Israel and fight. And then we have kids. And Moshe says, no, no. First you'll set up your kids. And then you'll pursue your business interests. He gives them this subtle, nuanced mussar. Your kids come before your business interests. It doesn't matter. You have great livestock. East of the Yarden is fertile land for you to be able to raise them. So Chazal understand, when a person is predisposed towards money, when a person is drawn towards money, when they evaluate everything in life in money, then it's going to affect and influence them even to the point of accidental murder. You'll be less careful, you'll be less vigilant. Your entire decision-making system, your judgment becomes clouded. The whole way in which you approach the world becomes distorted, so much so that those 2.5 tribes who had this ambition professionally and the pursuit of money, that distorted their vision. They became more predisposed. Therefore, they had proportionally the same amount as everyone else. What happens to the individual who murders accidentally? He runs to an Ir Miklat. How long does he stay in the Ir Miklat? Till the Kohen Gadol of his generation dies. Gemara says that the Kohen Gadol's mother used to bake cookies and send them to the Ir Miklats to make sure. Why? If you were an inmate in an Ir Miklat, you were davening every day, I want to go home. You're davening for the Kohen Gadol to die so you could get out. You know, what if you went to an Ir Miklat on the first day of the new Kohen Gadol's term? Kohen Gadol was 30 years old. Could be there for a long time. So the Kohen Gadol's mother would try to influence positively those who were incarcerated, I don't know if that's the right word, even in an Ir Miklat, to make sure they wouldn't daven the Kohen Gadol would die. Why is this tied to the Kohen Gadol? What did the poor Kohen Gadol do? He's up in Yerushalayim. He's doing the Avoda. What did he do that in all these Ari Miklat, you have all these people who their term is dependent on his lifespan? What did he ever do wrong? So Rav Volbe has a beautiful sefer called Zriya Ubinyan, Planting and Building. It's a very small pamphlet. It's a beautiful sefer he has about educating. About education, about educating, about parenting to our children. It actually is related to the end of our parsha, which talks about Adam Eitz HaSadeh. The end of our parsha talks about when you go to war, don't cut down a fruit tree because man is likened to a tree. So in this small book, Rav Volbe, you could finish it in half of one sitting. Rav Volbe says that our attitude, which shapes our philosophy, our methodology of parenting, of education, are these two images, planting and building. You see, when you build something, it's very rigid. There's no creativity. There's no organic growth. It's very rigid. It follows exact plans. On the other hand, when you plant, something grows, the creativity, it blossoms, but it could grow wild. There's nothing that shapes it. So therefore, it's this blend of planting and building. And he talks about the notion, planting demands sunlight, oxygen, nourishment, so on, what building requires, and the method of parenting is the combination of the two. Ki adam eitz hasadeh, the child is like a seed. There's enormous potential within, but if you want to bring the potential innate within the seed to fruition, to produce great fruit, delicious, succulent fruit that make you proud, then you have to nurture them, this combination of planting or building. So he goes through the Sefer of Volbe and he says all kinds of ideas and wonderful suggestions about how to parent, about how to teach. And then he says, but you know what the most important thing you have to do as a parent is? The thing that's most neglected by most parents, which is the greatest influence on your success as a parent. You know what it is? Daven. Davening for your children. davening for your children. And he says, where do I get this from? He says, because the Gemara says, you know why this was all tied to the Kohen Gadol? Because the Kohen Gadol, as the leader of his generation, had a responsibility to daven that there never be accidental murder. And when there's an accidental murder, it's a reflection of his failure or lack of sincerity or success in offering that tefillah. The awesome responsibility of leaders, Rav Obi writes there, he says, of a rabbi of a shul, the principal of a school, and the parent of a home. Whatever, wherever you have a role of leadership, in addition to all the other initiative you take, among, and maybe foremost among the responsibilities we have, is to daven for those for whom we are responsible. Kohen Gadol should have been davening day in and day out, that under his watch and in his term, that there never be accidental murder, and when it happens, it's a reflection on him. He didn't succeed in influencing the generation to be so careful such murder couldn't happen. He didn't daven as well as he could. So Rav Olba says, and he describes, he provides there, the Chazon Ish wrote a tefillah, parents should say for their children. He said, some say it during candlelighting, some say it every day in Shemona Esrei. The Chazon Ish wrote a three-sentence tefillah that parents say for their children, hopes, wishes, dreams, protecting, taking care of them. And therefore, we do all these other things for our children. We do all this parenting, we spend enormous amounts of money for our children. And too many neglect that we can do all of that, but in the end of the day, whether we'll get nachas from them, how they will turn out. There have been the most amazing parents, phenomenal role models, the best education and tutors, the finest of everything. And Nebuch, the children, did not give them nachas. And you have parents who are a disaster. Their own lives are a disaster. They're in no position to parent. And yet, somehow, their children, they grow up, it's Hashem's sense of humor, and they give unbelievable nachas to the whole community. So what determines? The answer is, with everything we do, ultimately it's up to Hashem. And says Rav Olba, never neglect Hashem's role in the outcome of the children that we're parenting. Never neglect or stop or forget to daven for our children. It was a gift that my family got for my father, and I later did this on my own talis bag. People have on the talis bag their name on the cover of the talis bag. You want to identify your own talis bag. You want the gabbai to know how to call you up. I'm half joking. Some people have their name to get called up for an aliyah woven into the talis bag. Most people just have their name on the talis bag. So I have, not only in the front of the talis bag is my name, and woven on the back of the talis bag are each of my children's names. And when I daven, I turn my talis bag over and I try to leave it somewhere near where I'm davening. When I get to the Amida, that I remember, with everything I'm responsible for, the community, my life, all the hopes and aspirations and dreams, with everything I'm davening for, those names are the first and foremost, my most greatest responsibility that I have. And we learn that from the story here of the Ir Miklat. The individual who goes to the Ir Miklat brings his Rebbe with him. Talmud, Jagala, Megalan Rabo Imo, from a Gemara in Makos. We send his Rebbe with him. And from here, we know that Hashem comes to Golus with us. How do you know? Why does he go his Rebbe? Nebuchadnezzar's Rebbe, could you imagine? Somebody climbed a ladder, lifted an axe, the head went flying off, somebody died accidentally. They call me and say, Rabbi, I got some bad news. You're not going to be seeing your family for a while. I said, what are you talking about? What did I do? He says, I got to go to Golus. I got to go to Anir Miklat, and you're coming with me. So I'm coming with you. What did I do? So the Pasuk here describes that when the individual goes to the Ir Miklat, he's given life. Vachai. He's given life. We protect him. We preserve his life. Even though the Goel Adam, those family members who are entitled to exact justice and to kill him, he's protected. It's like the game of tag. He gets to home base. Here, Miklat, he's protected. He's good to go. Megal and Rabo Imo, why does his Rebbe have to go with him? So the Gemara says, Vachai. It's an amazing thing. The Rambam elucidates. He says, you know, if you went to prison, what would you take with you? What's your most core, critical, central things that you need that you can't live without? Most people would say my phone. I can't live without my phone. I don't know, my TV. What are the things that you can't live without? The things that you need that you can't live without. My brother-in-law's father, who I was telling you about, a Tzedek Tirdof, his most creative judgment, which was later overturned, but he shared his most proud and creative judgment. Somebody had violated several acts of petty theft and come before his court again. And it was time he said, I got to throw you in jail. You need to serve some time. You need to learn your lesson. The man claimed he was the primary caretaker of his mother, and if he would be incarcerated, she would suffer. That would be unfair to her. So his conclusion, his judgment was that he could have prison at home, home prison, but he couldn't have a TV in the house. He would have to spend his time thinking, reading, reflecting on what he did wrong and how he could be better. He knew it would be overturned, and it was overturned. Anyone know why it was overturned? It was deemed what? Cruel and unusual punishment. It was deemed cruel and unusual punishment. So most people, they'd have to go to an ear miklat and they'd say, I need my TV, flat screen, I need direct cable, 1,000 channels, HD. And without that, I'll surely die. And it says, V'chai, you have to provide for me to live. I need my phone, I need my barbecue, I need my echves, my 40 pairs of shoes. Who knows? Different people have different things that they can never live without. So the Torah says, you know what should be the thing you can't live without? Your Rebbe. Torah. V'chai. Ki hem chayenu v'orech yameinu. The thing, the v'chai, that you can't live without is access to Torah. So I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. The Rebbe doesn't have to go today. You just have to have your phone so you could stream the Rebbe over the phone. But v'chai, you have to be able to provide the Torah as well. Preserving boundaries. We have what we call Hasagas Gvul. We talked about this last Shavuos. Unfair competition. It's used in another context in our Parsha, but unfair competition. Witnesses, the role of witnesses who can testify. Kisete lemelchama laivecha. What happens when you go to war on your enemy? What happens when we go to war? Which the Or HaChaim HaKadosh in our Parsha says, Kisete lemelchama laivecha. Again, we're reading this in the month of Elul. Who is the oivecha? Who is your enemy? Who's our enemy? I told the story before. I wrote it in an article about my daughter who got this book to fill out all these little questions. What's your name? Who's your best friend? What's your hobby? What are those books called? I don't even remember what these little books are called. Diary, a journal. And she was, I don't know, like 6 years old at the time, and she asked my wife, the book very bizarrely asks, who's your arch nemesis? So she's filling out the whole thing. Who's your best friend? And what's your favorite ice cream? And what's your this? Says, who's your arch nemesis? And she brings it to my wife. She said, what's an arch nemesis? She said, oh, Tamimala, you don't have any, but it means like your enemy. Anyway, she goes and plays some more. And later, Yecheved goes to check in the book. What did she fill in that spot? Who is your arch nemesis? And my little Tamimala wrote, my Yetzer Hara. So who is the Oivecha? The Or HaChaim HaKadosh says, Ki seitze la milchama al Oivecha. Says the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, who's the oivecha? Who is our greatest enemy? This Pasha is the prescription for how to combat the Yetzer Hara within us. The obligation to have overtures for peace when we're going to war. This is Los Baal Tashchis. You can't be wasteful. Don't cut down a fruit tree. And then we get to the end of our Pasha, which is what I want to study with you for our last 10 minutes or so. The end of our Pasha, which is the story of the Egla Arufa. The story of the Egla Arufa. What is the story of the Egla Arufa? Says the Torah, I'm on page 1042 in the Art Scroll Stone Chumash, Perek Chaf Aleph Pasuk Aleph. Perek Chaf Aleph Pasuk Aleph. Ki matzei chalal ba'adamah she'ashem lekech ha'nasei nachal erishter nofel ba'sadeh lo nadam mihi kahu. You find a corpse lying in the field and you have no idea who is the murderer. How did he die? So the elders and the judges of the generation go out and they measure how far is this corpse from the different areas. Says Rashi, who are the zakeinachim miyuchadim shebizakeinacha? Elu Sanhedrin gedola. So who do you find? Not some lower court, not some lower level judges. Who gets on their hands and knees with a tape measure? Who leaves the Beis Hamikdash? Who leaves Har Habayis? Who leaves Yerushalayim to go anywhere in Israel where a corpse is, an unidentified corpse is found, and brings their tape measure to start measuring? It's none other than the Sanhedrin Gedola. It's none other than the members of the Sanhedrin, a delegation of 5 members of the great Sanhedrin. The Supreme Court leaves their chamber to occupy themselves with this activity. Umadadu, they measure mimakum shachal shochev, from where the corpse lies. That's where they measure. In every direction, they measure in order to see which city is deemed closest to this corpse. The Balaturim says, we'll come back to that Balaturim. We'll come back to that. Pasuk Beis, V'yatzu, Zekenecha v'shoftecha, umadudu al harim ha'shiv v'sachal, the Zekenecha go out, and they measure the area. V'haya ha'yera krovay al-achala, v'achuz zeknei ha'yera hu'y eglas bakar, asher lo ubadba, asher lo mashcha ba'ol. And then, when they determine which city it is, so the elders of that city take out a heifer, and one which has never worked, which has never pulled a yoke. They take it down to this valley. What valley? A harsh valley. It's not a fertile valley with soft soil. An area which has not worked. And they break the back of the neck. It's a very graphic and harsh end for this poor heifer. But you kill the heifer. The Kohanim approach. Hashem, in fact, empowered them. They're the ones who are supposed to resolve all issues. Here's the incredible part of this thing. So the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court, leaves their chamber to come out and occupy themselves with this activity. The Kohanim, the great priests, the righteous priests come, and what do? They wash their hands over the heifer that was killed in this valley, and they say, "V'anu v'amri yadenu lo shavchu es adam hazeh ve'einenu lo ra'u." Our hands have not spilled this blood, and our eyes did not see. We testify, we swear, we take an oath, we didn't do it. We're not the murderers, and we didn't see who is the one who murdered. Kaper la'amcha Yisrael asher padis Hashem, atone for the people that you have redeemed. Atitein dam naki bekerav amcha Yisrael. Don't place innocent blood in their midst. V'nikaper lahem adam, v'yatat v'ayar adam anakim mekirbecha, kitasa ayasher b'nei Hashem. So this is a very bizarre story. Corpse is found unidentified. We measure the closest city. We see that we take the great dignitaries to do the measuring. The Kohanim, another group of great dignitaries, confess that it wasn't them. And did we suspect it was them? That they need to confess? They doth protest too much. Why are they saying we didn't do it? Did we have a havamina that they did do it? Is that really our thought process? And what is this doing here? Look at Rashi. Yadenu lo shofcha, v'chi alsa alev shezikne bezden shofchi damimim, elo lo reinu upitarnu below mezonos below levia, v'akoanim omrim. What were they really saying? They were not saying we didn't do the murder. We never suspected them of doing the murder. What were they really saying? We'll come back to it in a moment. So the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim says, why are you doing this bizarre process? The Supreme Court and the Kohanim, you break the neck of the Egla, and then they confess. Why are you doing this? The Rambam writes in his Mor Nevuchim, Ulai bepirsam ha'in yodeh ha'oreg v'yomar mishiyado osham inyano ha'oreo hazeh amaslos ploni hu ha'oreg v'achar sheyodeh ha'igia ha'toela shim lo yargu beizden ha'melach yargu sheyesh l'arog b'maslos, so on and so forth. Says the Rambam that it's a pragmatic exercise. The more fanfare, the more pomp and circumstance, the bigger the headline you make, the more likely you'll find the murderer. How do you get on America's Most Wanted? By doing an Egla Arufa ceremony, and then you're going to draw the attention, which will help spread the word of the murder, and maybe somebody will come forth and testify, and maybe you'll find the perpetrator, and maybe you'll avenge the blood of the victim, or at least honor the blood of the victim by finding the murder. The Rambam says this whole peculiar practice is peculiar by design because it's meant to publicize and to draw attention. The Ramban here says no. Egla Arufa is a chok. There's no rational explanation. And not coincidentally, it has many parallel laws to what is the archetypal chok? What is the model of all chukim? In fact, it's the beginning of the parsha by that name. Para Aduma. And many of the laws of the Egla Arufa are like the Para Aduma. Neither can have a blemish, neither could have worked. So the Ramban says those parallels are not coincidental. Those parallels are revealing that just like Para Aduma is a chok, so too the Egla Arufa is a chok. The Ibn Ezra here has a different approach. The Ibn Ezra says, it's not just trying to attain atonement for the murder, because we don't know who did the murder. Look at the Ibn Ezra, Ve'einenu lo ra'u. Yitachen she'ashem tziva lasos kein ha'ir ha'krova, ki lulei she'asu avera kedumala lo nizdame lem she'yaharig adam karav mehem. U'machshavas Hashem amku v'gavu le'in keitz etzlenu. Says the Ibn Ezra that if a murder happened in a vicinity of a community, it says something about that community and its values and its morals. That a community that protects its citizens, a community that preaches high morals and values, this senseless and anonymous murder would not have happened in its vicinity. And therefore, this whole process of the measuring and the city and the people from that city, the representatives coming out and making this confession, is not because we actually suspect them of being the murderer, but it says a lot about a community, what they tolerate, or what could have happened there, and maybe its values that were learned there. So the Rambam says, publicize it, maybe we'll find out the murder. The Ramban says, don't try to understand it, it's a chok, just like Paraduma. The Ibn Ezra says, it's not about the murderer getting atonement, it's about the community reflecting and doing introspection to evaluate how they need to improve what they could have done more. But Rashi, and it's really a Mishnah and Sota, has a different interpretation. The Mishnah and Sota asks a more fundamental question. V'chi al datenu also, shezikne bezdin shofchei damim hein? Do we really think that the elders, the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court, are the murderers? Ella, shalaba al yadenu b'tarnu b'lo mazon, v'lo reinu v'nachnu b'lo levaya. What's their declaration they make? The murdered person did not come within our presence, and we sent him off without food, and that we didn't escort him. Levaya. We call a levaya, levaya, because we're escorting the deceased to the next world. But the word levaya doesn't mean funeral. The word levaya means to be melaveh, a melaveh neshek. To be melaveh is to escort someone. So the Gemara says, we learn from our parsha, how did this individual get murdered when he left the city? Nobody walked him out. Now, nobody walked him out. What does that have to do with the fact that maybe an hour, maybe a day, maybe several days later he got murdered? What's the connection between the two? And the answer is, the connection between the two is, if nobody walked him out, maybe he didn't think his life was worth living. If nobody valued him or validated him, if nobody honored him, then he maybe didn't honor himself to live a life in which he was protected. He himself became vulnerable. That's what the Maharal writes. Maharal says, someone who's not escorted, who travels alone, is vulnerable, is in danger. Says the Maharal, why? Because a person feels isolated, abandoned, alone, and unimportant. And when a person has those feelings of insecurity, feels alone and unimportant, then they're not in a position to protect themselves or to secure themselves. When a person is welcomed or feels companionship or love, has self-esteem, feels of great value, they walk around, they project a very different aura. And therefore, they're much less vulnerable and they're much more protected. And that's what this end of our parsha is really all about. The episode and the ceremony, according to Rashi and this Mishnah and Sota, are really as much about not only the victim, the corpse, but the community and how we treat people. And the responsibility to be malave, the responsibility to treat everyone with a great sense of self. Which is why it appears where it does. What does this have to do with the end of the parsha? Right before this we saw, if you go out to war, kisei tzei l'milchama, and then, punkt, right here you have the story of the Egla Rufa. The Kli Yakar deals with that question. And the Kli Yakar says, because we just learned the fruit tree, don't cut it down, because you will deny that tree the ability to yet produce more fruit. So too, this individual who was senselessly murdered, he'll never see further fruit. Whether literally he won't have children, or the mitzvos, the good deeds, the life he could have lived, his potential, the fruit of his life, are unrealized. And that's the connection, says the Kli Yakar, between the Egla Arufa and the don't cut down a fruit tree prematurely, that there's so much potential, there's so much possibility, there's so much future, that we have to protect and preserve it, that people be able to live. Rav Chaim Dov Keller of tells in Chicago at a different pshat. He says, whenever you see in the Torah reference to war, right afterwards you have the reference to the importance of life. So for example, we have reference to law, to war, and then what do we have after it? We have the laws of Erchin, in Parshas Bechukosai. What are the laws of Erchin? The laws of if a person pledges their value as a sacrifice in the Beis HaMikdash. So that follows up. After death comes the reaffirmation of the value of life. You have it with Erchin in Parshas Bechukosai, and you have it here in Parshas Shoftim. That after Kiseitei LaMilchama, so a person comes back from war and they say, what's the value of life? People are killed in war senselessly. The whole war is people trying to kill one another. What's the value of a life? Therefore, the Torah follows it up with the law of the Egla Arufa to remind us every life is of inestimable value. That when there's an anonymous corpse, the world stops. The Supreme Court comes, and the Kohanim of the city come, and the whole tumult is done because each life is of inestimable value. The Baal Turim says, what's the connection between the two? Ki matzei chalal, some smach leparshas mechama, shebashas mechama, derech limtzo chalalam. When is it that you're more likely to find a corpse is in a war, and that's why we have the connection between the two. But we see it as a much more fundamental connection, a connection having to do with the value of each and every life. Have a great day.